Edward's estate when De Vries visited England in 1878. We talked for a short time about all kinds of things, the country house, which is very large and beautiful, the surroundings, also very beautiful, politics, my journey, etc., De Vries eagerly wrote his grandmother that night. Thereafter, Darwin took me to his room, and we talked about scientific subjects, at first about tendrils in connection with our former correspondence. Darwin took De Vries on a tour of his garden, handing him a peach along the way. Later, De Vries gushed to his grandmother that he was received so kindly and cordially as I never had dared hope for. When De Vries returned home to the Netherlands, he and Darwin kept up the correspondence about plants. But in a letter he wrote Darwin in 1881, De Vries abruptly changed the subject. Now he was consumed with heredity. "I have always been especially interested in your hypothesis of pangenesis," De Vries told Darwin, "and have collected a series of facts in favor of it." De Vries roamed the countryside for sports of nature, rare plants that sprouted weird growths or displayed odd colors. He wanted to create an herbarium of monstrosities, he later told a friend. By breeding them, he hoped to prove Darwin's theory of pangenesis right. When Weismann unveiled the concept of the germline, De Vries recognized its importance. As a botanist, though, he found it parochial. Plants, like animals, were made of cells that contained nuclei, and inside those nuclei were chromosomes. When plant cells divided, they also made a new set of chromosomes. But plants did not wall off their germ cells early in development. An apple tree would grow for years before producing germ cells that could give rise to pollen grains or seeds. A cutting from a willow could grow into an entire tree, complete with roots, branches, and leaves. A hidden potential to produce new plants must be spread throughout their cells, De Vries thought. While pangenesis might have its problems, he thought it had to be the foundation of any true understanding of heredity. Darwin died in 1882, leaving De Vries to search for that understanding without the guidance of his guru. He began running experiments with his monsters. He crossed them with ordinary plants, and sometimes their bizarre traits turned up in later generations. De Vries came up with a theory of his own. Every cell contained invisible particles that were responsible for passing traits from one generation to the next. Under some circumstances, the particles in somatic cells could guide the development of a new organism. In honor of Darwin, De Vries called the particles pangenes. In 1889, De Vries published Intracellular Pangenesis, in which he distilled over a decade's worth of work. Hardly any scientists took notice of it. One of the few who did advised De Vries not to mention pangenesis again. De Vries did not give up. In the 1890s, he noticed that monstrosities crossed with regular flowers produced regular ratios of offspring. De Vries thought that flowers could have different numbers of pangenes in them, and those numbers were what determined traits in their offspring. Despite his struggles with these ratios, De Vries became convinced that pangenes were real and that their changes were what made evolution possible. Pangenes could abruptly change in a process he called mutation, and flowers that inherited a mutation abruptly became a new species. De Vries's mutation theory was pushing him far from Darwin, who had argued for the gradual evolution of species through tiny steps. One day early in 1900, De Vries got a letter from a friend who was familiar with his obsession with hybrid plants. His friend thought De Vries might be interested in a 35-year-old paper by a certain Mendel. When De Vries scanned the paper, he was stunned that a Moravian monk he had never heard of had found the same patterns he had. He had even come up with a theory of invisible hereditary factors to account for it. By an unparalleled coincidence, two other scientists studying inheritance, William Bateson and Carl Correns, also stumbled across Mendel's work at about the same time. They all realized that they had been scooped, and they also recognized just how important Mendel's experiments had been. Before 1900, scientists didn't have the right frame of mind to appreciate them. It took Darwin and Galton establishing heredity as a scientific question. It took Weismann and others to look closely at cells, to ask how heredity was transmitted. De Vries, Bateson, and Correns all began sharing the belated news about Mendel. Bateson emerged as the leader of the campaign. He and his colleagues demonstrated that animals could display the same ratios as plants. Even certain hereditary diseases in people fit the pattern. A British doctor named Archibald Garrett noticed that a condition he called alkaptonuria, which turned urine black, tended to run in families. Sometimes when two seemingly healthy parents started a family, about a quarter of their children fell ill. That ratio fit Mendel's predictions. The parents must be carriers, each carrying a recessive factor. "The whole problem of heredity has undergone a complete revolution," Bateson declared. "Mendel's discoveries could at last mature into a true science." Bateson christened it genetics. No sooner was genetics born, however, than it was hurled into battle. Some scientists felt that Mendel must have made a mistake. Some tried to get his neat ratios of hybrids and failed. Other critics found it inconceivable that physical particles could be inherited and give rise to every trait in an organism. De Vries went his own way. He accepted that Mendel's results were genuine, but he came to doubt they mattered much to big evolutionary changes. Those could only come about through the appearance of major new mutations. Evolution didn't creep forward, De Vries believed. It leaped. De Vries unpacked this idea in his sprawling two-volume work, The Mutation Theory, in 1903. His theory that new mutations could produce new species in a single leap proved sensational. It finally earned De Vries the fame that had escaped him in earlier years. When he came to the United States to give lectures about his mutation theory, newspapers put his face on their front pages. It was on one of those tours that De Vries paid his first visit to Luther Burbank in 1904. By then, Burbank no longer considered himself simply a plant breeder. The honors that scientists had heaped on him persuaded him he was a genius of heredity. When scientists visited Burbank, he would regale them with a grand theory, perhaps as original as Darwin's, he modestly declared, that the universe consisted of what he called organized lightning. The scientists who listened to Burbank's ramblings politely nodded, said that they were unqualified to judge, and hoped they could gain access to his legendary garden. De Vries traveled to Burbank's garden to find support for his mutation theory. His own evening primroses produced mutants from time to time, but he had yet to find another species that displayed mutations so clearly. De Vries's gigantic theory had come to rest on precious little evidence, like an elephant trying to ride a bicycle. Maybe Burbank's new varieties were, in fact, a wealth of new mutants. Between bites of Burbank's stoneless plums, De Vries interrogated his host. Burbank had become wary of sharing his secrets by then. He would sometimes force his workers to empty their pockets to make sure they weren't smuggling out his prized seeds. If they chatted across the picket fence with a passerby, he would fire them. With De Vries, Burbank was more forthcoming. He explained how he had crossed plums, selecting the ones with smaller and smaller stones. He described how he set about breeding cacti without spines as a new source of food for cattle. He searched for varieties to cross, each missing different parts of their spines. Over generations, they became soft enough for Burbank to stroke over his cheek. De Vries left Santa Rosa impressed by Burbank's passion. The sole aim of all his labors is to make plants that will add to the general welfare of his fellow beings, De Vries wrote later. As a scientific mission, however, the journey ended up a disappointment. De Vries hoped his visit would shed light on how plants acquired new traits. Burbank's experience did not throw any light on this question, he concluded. De Vries's time with Burbank marked the high water mark in the careers of both men. When he traveled to Santa Rosa, De Vries had become famous as one of the founders of modern genetics and as the author of a controversial new theory about mutations that seemed to overthrow Darwin. Burbank, meanwhile, had become a celebrity as both a mystic of nature and a keen businessman. Things would never be so good for either of them again. In the years that followed, De Vries would keep fighting for his mutation theory. But the only organisms that had experienced one of De Vries's dramatic mutations were his evening primroses. It turned out De Vries was fooled by an illusion of breeding. What he took to be an entirely new mutation was actually a combination of old genetic variants. De Vries refused to accept these facts, retiring to the village of Lunteren in the Dutch countryside. For the next 16 years, the villagers would sometimes spot a tall, bearded man walking amidst a garden of primroses. In December 1904, a few months after De Vries's first visit, Burbank got a letter from the Carnegie Institution. Andrew Carnegie had set up the institution 2 years earlier to fund important scientific research. Carnegie himself believed that some of the money should go to Burbank, whom he called a genius. The letter informed Burbank he would shortly receive $10,000 for the purpose of furthering your experimental investigations in the evolution of plants. The institution would send him another $10,000 the next year, and the year after that, with no clear end in mind. The popular press released a fresh flurry of profiles of Burbank, pointing to the Carnegie cash as science's seal of approval. In 1906, a botanist named George Shull arrived to help Burbank write up scientific reports about his research. Shull found Burbank to be an artist of nature. As a scientist, however, he was a phantom. When Shull asked Burbank for experimental records, the old horticulturalist might hand him a few sheets of paper on which he had scribbled notes in pencil. This was a rich, sweet, delicious, superb pear, as good as Bartlett, perhaps much better, he wrote on one sheet. He sliced one of the pears in half and stamped it on the page, letting the juice stain the paper. Shull tried instead to talk to Burbank to extract useful information. Burbank informed him that he was the greatest authority of plant life that ever lived. He claimed to have already discovered Mendel's results on his own, and yet he also declared that acquired characters could be transmitted from one generation to the next. Environment is the architect of heredity, Burbank said. When Shull pressed him for the concrete details of his work, Burbank grew so irritated he started avoiding Shull around the gardens. It wasn't Shull's line of questioning that annoyed him so much as the fact that the young botanist seemed to be preparing to explode his legend. Indeed, Shull reported back to the Carnegie Institution that it would be impossible to use any of the plants to test Mendel's theory of inheritance. In 1910, the Carnegie Institution sent Burbank their last check. Their $60,000 bought them a single report from Shull about rhubarb. As the Carnegie money dried up, a swarm of businessmen descended on Burbank, proposing deals to make him staggeringly rich. Some of the hucksters set about publishing a lavish, costly encyclopedia of his life's work. That venture collapsed into bankruptcy in 1916. Other businessmen set up the Luther Burbank Company to sell his plants directly to customers rather than to nurseries. They mismanaged the venture, unable to align their supply to demand. Things got so desperate that the company started shipping ordinary cacti in place of Burbank's spineless variety. Before putting the plants in the mail, company workers simply scrubbed off the spines with a wire brush. The Luther Burbank Company went bankrupt as well. Burbank managed to hold on to much of his wealth despite these disasters, but they permanently tarnished his reputation. By the 1920s, Burbank had become an untrustworthy businessman whom scientists no longer revered. He spent his final years puttering around his Santa Rosa farm, cared for by his young second wife, Elizabeth, along with a few assistants. In 1926, Burbank died at age 77. Thousands of people came to his funeral at a nearby park, and then his body was brought back to his house, where it was buried. Nothing stood over his grave except a cedar of Lebanon. I would like to think of my strength going into the strength of a tree, he once said. Elizabeth sold off his remaining plants to Stark Brothers, just as Hyatt had sold his delicious apples 3 decades before. Burbank's garden tools went to Henry Ford. After his death, Burbank enjoyed a longer stretch of fame than DeVries had. His face reappeared in popular culture for decades. As late as 1948, the beer company Anheuser-Busch was using his likeness in their ads. In a full-page ad for Budweiser, Burbank stands in his garden, holding out a rose for a mailman to smell. Both Budweiser and Burbank's varieties, the ad declared, were great contributions to good taste. In the picture, Burbank has a grandfatherly smile, a shock of gray hair, a starched collar, and a black tie. The image belonged to an earlier chapter in the history of heredity, when breeders could use their intuitions to produce new fruits and flowers, becoming masters of forces they didn't understand. By the 1940s, when the beer ad appeared, heredity meant something very different. It was now a precise molecular science in the hands of some, and a monstrous rationale for oppression and genocide in the hands of others. Even the plants and yeast that went into Budweiser beer in the 1940s had become products of scientific breeding, rather than of Burbank's old wizardry. There is another picture created after Burbank's death that still feels fresh. The painter Frida Kahlo paid a visit to Burbank's garden in 1930. She had moved from Mexico to San Francisco a few months earlier. Her husband, the artist Diego Rivera, had accepted a commission to paint murals for American patrons, the first of which would capture the spirit of California. Kahlo and Rivera took the short drive from San Francisco to Santa Rosa to visit the home of a hero of the state. Burbank's widow, Elizabeth, gave the couple a tour around the grounds, showed them the cedar under which Burbank was buried, told them stories about her late husband, and gave them some photographs of him to take with them. Kahlo painted Burbank on a stark, tan California landscape. High clouds moved across the sky, and behind him grew a pair of trees. One tree was small, with oversized fruits. The other grew clusters of balls in different colors, perhaps patterned after one of Burbank's mother trees. From the knees up, Burbank looked like he does in many photographs, with a tranquil expression on his face, wearing a dark suit and holding a plant. In this case, he's holding a philodendron, a vine-like plant with lobed leaves that Kahlo painted to be as big as his chest. Below the knees, Burbank was transformed by Kahlo's powerful imagination. His legs disappeared into the stump of a tree. Kahlo cut away the earth to reveal the tree's roots, which pierced the head, the heart, the stomach, and the legs of a corpse. Burbank had no children of his own who could carry his hereditary particles after his death. His fame eventually faded. But many of the varieties that he developed continued to grow, to make seeds of their own, and to be replaced by their offspring. Some, like the Burbank potato, bear his name. Others grow namelessly, Burbank's handiwork having been long forgotten. He had found an immortality here on Earth, his work and his plants extending their existence in intimate replication. A few months before he died, a reporter paid Burbank a visit to ask him about religion. Burbank was such a familiar figure in the United States that reporters would ask his opinion about everything from jazz to crime. At one point in the interview, Burbank said that Jesus had been a wonderful psychologist and an infidel to boot. Just as he was an infidel then, I am an infidel today. Now the river of letters that poured into Burbank's house turned furious. Prayer groups formed to beseech God to help Burbank see the light. To respond to the attacks, Burbank arranged to give a speech, a sermon really, at the First Congregational Church of San Francisco on the last Sunday of January 1926. More than 2,500 people crammed the pews. The 76-year-old Burbank told them that he was no atheist. He subscribed to what he hoped would someday become a religion of humanity, worshiping a God as revealed to us gradually, step by step, by the demonstrable truths of our Savior, science, he said to his audience. Burbank didn't see the point of wasting time pondering hypothetical eternities in heaven or hell. Heredity, the continuity of life through the generations, was vast enough for him. All things, plants, animals, and men, are already in eternity, traveling across the face of time, he said. Chapter 3. This Race Should End With Them. Vineland began as an idea for a perfect city. In 1861, a businessman named Charles Landis traveled from Philadelphia into the empty pine barrens of New Jersey. He bought 20,000 acres and laid down a map of lots. He called it Vineland. Farmers bought land to grow crops on the fertile soil, and retired Civil War soldiers later came to work in new glass manufacturing plants. The idea of Vineland endured into the 21st century, in the generous width of its main streets, in the triumphant design of its municipal buildings. But a new city has grown on top of Landis's idea, a city that lost its factories, that turned its outlying farms into suburbs, that brought in immigrants not from New England, but from Mexico and India. I came to Vineland on a bright, cold day in February, driving along South Main Road, one of the original roads that ran along the city's eastern edge. I passed a bleak, treeless row of gas stations, supermarkets, cell phone shops, and liquor stores. At the intersection with Landis Avenue, I pulled into a Wawa store parking lot and walked inside to buy a bag of peanuts. Car mechanics and home health aides were ordering sandwiches and coffee and lottery tickets. When I came back outside, I looked up at the grumpy, overheated winter sky. The clouds were tormenting the South Main traffic with tantrums of rain. My phone buzzed with a tornado warning for all of South Jersey. I pulled a wool cap onto my head and took a walk, eating peanuts for lunch. The convenience store driveway curved around a wedge of grass by the intersection. A massive, rounded stone stood in the center of the wedge, surrounded by bushes and spotlights anchored into the wood chips. I walked over to inspect it. The stone was inscribed with a name, S. Olin Garrison. No explanation, no date. The drivers of the passing cars and trucks paid the tombstone no notice. I doubt any of them knew who S. Olin Garrison was, let alone why he was buried in front of a Wawa store. Turning my back to the noisy commercial strip, I looked eastward across a huge empty field, crossed by a worn concrete path. I walked down the path, under a row of leafless trees that leaned over the left side. The trees had lost some of their boughs, and some were dead, but you could still sense that someone had planted them in grand, rational intervals long ago. The line of trees led my eye across the field to a pair of small, square gazebos in the distance, tilted on the frost-heaved earth. Beyond them was a scattering of old buildings. A late 19th-century edifice had a dome sprouting from one corner. Around it huddled a few old houses and outbuildings, falling into disrepair. I had spent the morning at a nearby historical society, looking over photographs of this spot from over a century earlier. Now that I was at the spot itself, I could see it as it looked on an October morning in 1897. There was no Wawa store, no stores at all for that matter. People passed by on foot, bicycle, or horseback. South Main Road and Landis Avenue bordered a 125-acre farm with pumpkin patches, apple orchards, and asparagus beds. A high gate stood at the corner with a name arching overhead, Vineland Training School. I had come here and cast my mind back because the Vineland Training School holds an important place in the history of heredity. Within the walls of the school, Mendel's research was applied to humans with disastrous consequences. What happened here would influence thoughts about heredity for generations. In 1897, a path led from the gate into the school grounds, flanked by newly planted trees. The gazebos were plum and freshly painted. The buildings bustled with 200 children. S. Olin Garrison, the founder and principal of the Vineland Training School, was very much alive in 1897, and I pictured him in the main school building, working at his desk. I listened to the sweet-toned bell ring from the school's clock tower in the distance. One morning in October 1897, an 8-year-old girl named Emma Wolverton arrived at the school gate. She was of average height, with a pretty round face, a wide nose, and thick, dark hair. It's impossible to know what Emma Wolverton was feeling that morning. In later years, she never got the chance to speak publicly for herself about her life. Of the many people who spoke for her, few particularly cared what she had to say. To most of them, she was a cautionary tale about all the ills that heredity could pass down through the generations. We do know a little about how Emma Wolverton ended up at that corner in Vineland. Her mother, Melinda, grew up in the northern part of the state. At age 17, she started to work as a servant. Soon, Melinda became pregnant with Emma and was thrown out of her master's house. Emma's father, reputed to be a bankrupt drunk, abandoned Melinda, and she ended up in an almshouse, where she gave birth to Emma in 1889. A charitable family took Melinda and her infant daughter out of the almshouse, and Melinda worked for them for a time. Soon she became pregnant again, and her benefactors insisted she get married to the father. Melinda and her husband had a second child together, after which the entire family moved into a rented house on a nearby farm. When Melinda got pregnant with a third child, her husband denied that the baby was his and abandoned her and the children. The farm where she rented a house was owned by a bachelor. Not long after her husband left, she moved in with the farmer, and he admitted he had fathered the new baby. Emma's benefactors tried to make things right yet again. They arranged a divorce between Emma's mother and her stepfather, and then a remarriage to the farmer. He consented, but only if Melinda got rid of the children other than his own. It was not long afterward that Emma was delivered to the front gate of the Vineland Training School. When S. Olin Garrison opened the school in 1888, he originally named it the New Jersey Home for the Education and Care of Feeble-Minded Children. He gave it a motto that would be stamped on their publications for decades to come. The true education and training for boys and girls of backward or feeble minds is to teach them what they ought to know and can make use of when they become men and women in years. Garrison was determined to provide a more humane place than the typical warehouses where those deemed feeble-minded had been abandoned in previous generations. Our aim is to awaken dormant faculties, to arouse ambition, to inject hope, and develop self-reliance, the school declared in a brochure. To get Emma admitted into the school, she was provided with a cover story. She didn't get along with other children in her regular school. That somehow raised the worry that she was feeble-minded. The definition of feeble-minded was sprawlingly vague in the late 1800s. People brought children to the Vineland Training School because they suffered epileptic convulsions. Others suffered from cretinism, a combination of dwarfism and intellectual disability. Others had a condition that would later be called Down syndrome. Emma belonged to a class of students who had no obvious symptoms, but were still judged unfit for society. When Emma arrived at the school, the staff gave her a thorough examination to judge whether she should be admitted. They observed no peculiarity in form or size of head. Emma understood their commands, and she could use a needle, carry wood, and fill a kettle. She knew a few letters, but couldn't read or count. But the staff found her obstinate and destructive, according to their notes, does not mind slapping and scolding. That was enough. The fact that she had been brought to Vineland because she had become a nuisance at home went unrecorded in her file. Her examiners declared her to be feeble-minded. They took her in. Emma moved into one of the cottages, which she shared with a small group of other children. Every day, the school filled Emma's schedule with classes, duties, and games. Along with reading and math, she was taught about nature on walks through the fields and woods. "We show them the connection between nature and their being," the deputy principal E.R. Johnstone said. "How dependent they are upon the plants and animals for their food and raiment." Emma and the other students spent much of their time singing in music classes. "Proper training will cause these songs of savagery to become the songs of civilization," Johnstone predicted. "Happiness first and all else follows" was a slogan that hung on the school walls. A team of wealthy Philadelphia women known as the Board of Lady Visitors paid for a donkey-pulled streetcar that the children could ride around the perimeter of the farm. The ladies built a merry-go-round at the school and a zoo stocked with bears, wolves, pheasants, and other creatures. Each year the school put on Christmas plays that residents of Vineland could attend, and each summer the school filled two train cars with students who traveled to Wildwood Beach for an outing by the sea. One of the earliest photographs of Emma shows her in the back of an open wagon filled with girls and teachers. She sits on a pile of hay, looking back toward the photographer, smiling. The picture is labeled, "Off for Camp." As an able-bodied child, Emma spent part of each day learning manual trades. She got a garden patch to raise fruits and vegetables. Girls like Emma were instructed in sewing, dressmaking, and woodworking, while the boys learned how to make shoes and rugs. The administrators claimed that this labor prepared the students to someday earn a living. But the school, like many asylums and prisons of the time, also depended on their work for their own income. Between May 1897 and May 1898, the school's records indicated, the students made 30 new three-piece suits, 92 pairs of overalls, 234 aprons, 107 new pairs of shoes, and 40 dressed dolls. They washed 275,130 pieces of laundry. They sold $8,160.81 of produce from the school farm, including 1,030 bushels of turnips, 158 baskets of cantaloupes, and 83,161 quarts of milk. The fact that feeble-minded children could do so much skilled labor was a paradox that never seems to have troubled the school's administration. Nor did they feel guilty for the money they made on the children's labor. "We are doing God's work," Johnstone explained. For evidence of their divine mission, the school pointed to the lives they had saved. They were also sparing society the burden of feeble-minded criminals. "The modern scientific study of the deficient and delinquent classes shows that a large portion of our criminals and inebriates are really born more or less imbecile," declared Isabel Craven, the president of the Board of Lady Visitors. Feeble-mindedness was not just present at birth, Craven believed, but was passed down from parents to children. She shared the standard late 19th century American belief in the heredity of bad behaviors. Somehow, feeble-mindedness could be both a medical disorder and the wages of sin, passed down from the sinners to their children. Writing in the school's annual report in 1899, Craven recounted one such story about an alcoholic woman in Germany in the late 1700s. She had 834 descendants, out of which 7 became murderers, 76 criminals of other sorts, 142 professional beggars, 64 charity cases, and 181 women who led disreputable lives, as Craven put it. The Vineland Training School was protecting future generations from this danger by removing feeble-minded children from circulation, ensuring that they never got a chance to have children of their own. What a legacy of crime and expense we may leave to the coming generation in our neglect to care for these incapable ones, Craven warned. Emma settled into her new home. Her teachers kept track of her progress in their notes. They logged her letters to Santa Claus, in which she asked for ribbons, gloves, dolls, and stockings. She learned to spell and count, although she struggled with arithmetic. She learned how to make a bed. Sometimes Emma's teachers made a note of bad conduct. At other times, they said she marched well. She acted in the Christmas plays. She mastered the cornet and played songs such as the Star-Spangled Banner in the school band. She learned to use a sewing machine to make shirtwaists, and then she learned how to build boxes to put them in, complete with paneled tops and mortise and tenon joints. When Emma became a teenager, she was ushered into the school's unpaid labor force. She is an almost perfect worker, a school administrator noted in her records. Emma waited tables in the school dining room and served as a helper in the woodworking class. She proved herself so capable that Johnstone made her his housekeeper and later put his infant son in her care. For a time, Emma worked as a kindergarten aide at the school, and a visitor to the school mistook her for one of the teachers. It was not the only time that visitors would comment on how normal she seemed. At age 17, Emma met a new member of the Vineland staff, a small balding man named Henry Goddard. Goddard moved into a new office above one of the workshops, which he filled with strange instruments and machines. He would give children tasks to perform for him, such as having them poke a wand into holes drilled into a sheet of wood as fast as they could. One day, it was Emma's turn to go to Goddard's office. "I have 5 cents in one pocket and 5 in another," he said to her. "How many cents have I?" 10, Emma replied. Dr. Goddard asked her another 16 questions about numbers. All told, she got 12 right and 5 wrong. 2 years later, Goddard summoned her again for another round of questions. "Use Philadelphia, money, and river in a sentence. Count backward from 20. Goddard's assistants praised her for every answer, although she got a fair number wrong. Later, Goddard reviewed her test and summed up her performance, her entire existence really, with a single word he had recently invented. Moron. Unbeknownst to Emma, Goddard had also started making discreet inquiries about her family. His assistants sought out friends of the Wolvertons for gossip. Goddard was sure of what they would discover, that Emma's family were morons too. Henry Goddard first came to the Vineland Training School to build a science of childhood, having escaped a disastrous childhood of his own. Around the time he was born in 1869 in Maine, his father was gored by a bull. The injury eventually cost the family their farm, and for a few years Goddard's father eked out a living as a day laborer before dying in 1878. Goddard spent the next 3 years with his older sister and her family, as his mother, a self-appointed Quaker missionary, vanished for months at a time to preach at friends' meetings across Canada and the Midwest. At age 12, Goddard was sent to Providence on a scholarship to a Quaker boarding school. "Nobody knew me or cared a whit whether I lived or died," Goddard recalled in his old age. After finishing his time in Quaker jail, as he called it, Goddard then went to Haverford College. He wasn't any fonder of that school either, considering it nothing but a convenient way to keep the sons of rich Philadelphia Quakers out of mischief. He came to hate the very institution of school. It was all a pointless exercise in the rote memorization of Latin and Greek, along with the endless worry that students would fall into sin. It made no difference to how people turned out, Goddard believed. The students from wealthy families went on to prosperous lives, while poorer students like Goddard were left to struggle. In all my adult life, he later said, I have felt keenly the defects of my early training. For all Goddard's scorn of schools, he ended up spending his life around them. He coached football at the University of Southern California for a while before teaching at high schools in Ohio and Maine. But at age 30, Goddard heard a lecture by the psychologist G. Stanley Hall that changed how he thought about education. Hall told his audience that schools could scientifically liberate the minds of children. Hall's own research had persuaded him that the mental development of children follows a predictable course, just like the metamorphosis of a wingless nymph into a dragonfly. If teachers and psychologists joined forces, Hall said, they could create a new kind of education based on science rather than superstitious traditions. Goddard immediately quit his teaching job and traveled to Massachusetts to study under Hall at Clark University. After getting his Ph.D., Goddard moved to West Chester, Pennsylvania, in 1899 to become a psychologist at the State Normal School. There, he began gathering the data that psychologists would need to transform teaching. Teachers from across Pennsylvania used Goddard's eye charts to test the vision of their students so that he could figure out how many children were doing badly in school simply because they had trouble reading books and chalkboards. Goddard sent out questionnaires to gauge the moral development of students from one grade to the next. Much as his mother had traveled to Quaker meetings, Goddard went from conference to conference to preach to teachers about the glory of child study. He asked his audiences to join him on a quest for a law of child nature which we can bank upon when once we have comprehended it. At a 1900 conference, Goddard met E.R. Johnstone, who invited him to visit the Vineland Training School. Goddard was impressed. The Vineland teachers didn't mindlessly deliver the same lessons over and over again. They experimented, revising their teaching based on what helped the students improve. Johnstone insisted that Goddard spend some time during his visit talking with the students themselves. I never dreaded anything more, Goddard later admitted, but it went better than he had expected, perhaps because Goddard knew what it felt like to be an abandoned child. Afterward, Johnstone congratulated him. You talked as though you were accustomed to talking to the feeble-minded, he said. Goddard came away from his visit convinced that Vineland was an exceptional place. A great family of happy, contented, but mentally defective children, he said. Over the next few years, he stayed in close contact with Johnstone, sharing ideas about using science to bring about a new way of teaching. In 1906, Johnstone invited Goddard to become Vineland's first director of research. To Goddard, it was a rare scientific opportunity. Vineland could reveal clues about the human mind that studies on ordinary children could not. Anatomists often studied simpler animals, flatworms or sea urchins, for example, to find important lessons that applied to humans as well. Psychologists might gain the same advantage by studying less complex minds. The training school at Vineland, New Jersey is a great human laboratory, Goddard declared. But when Johnstone announced Goddard's appointment, he also let slip a gloomier motivation for bringing aboard a psychologist. The feeble-minded were continuing to have more children who were inheriting their defects, and society thus faced an impending disaster. Degeneracy is increasing. Neurotic disease is increasing. Defectiveness is increasing, Johnstone warned. Building more Vinelands wouldn't hold back the tide. By the time more room is made, it is filled, and the waiting list is larger than before. We must stop the increase, Johnstone warned, and that means to find where they come from, why they come, and what to do to check the stream. Goddard didn't share Johnstone's bleak view, at least not at first. He hoped that someday his research at Vineland could lead to treatments that could lift up the mental state of the feeble-minded. Suppose we could find some way of exercising these brains so that other cells took up the work of the missing cells, he mused in 1907. Would we not find a far greater degree of intelligence than we have ever dreamed of? Before unlocking hidden intelligence, Goddard would first need a way to scientifically measure it. He wanted to assign intelligence a number, the way doctors measured blood pressure or body temperature or weight. In Goddard's day, doctors regularly diagnosed children as imbeciles and idiots, but they did so mostly by intuition. Goddard tried to craft a test that could drill down to the biological basis of intelligence. He guessed that the speed of the nervous system was crucial, and so he would put Vineland students in front of an electric key and tell them to tap it with their finger as fast as they could. It worked badly. Some students couldn't even understand what he wanted them to do. Goddard tried other tests. He had the students squeeze a dynamometer as hard as they could, to thread needles, to draw straight lines. But whenever Goddard sat down to analyze the test scores, he found they didn't hang together. A student might do well at one and miserably at another. After 2 years, my work was so poor, I had accomplished so little, that I went abroad to see if I could not get some ideas, Goddard later said. In Europe, Goddard visited universities, schools, and laboratories to observe their research. While he was staying in Belgium, a physician offhandedly gave him a sheet of paper with a series of questions on it. It was a new exam called the Simon Binet test, named after its creators, the French psychologist Alfred Binet and his assistant, Théodore Simon. At the request of the French government, Binet and Simon set out to design an exam schools could use to identify children who would need special help in class. Binet recognized he would need a way to measure intelligence, otherwise called good sense, practical sense, initiative, the faculty of adapting oneself to circumstances, he said. But how could he measure this quality, like a thermometer measures temperature? Instead of trying to measure it directly, Binet decided to measure how each child compared to other children. Ordinary children got better over time at mental tasks. Highly intelligent ones seemed to Binet to develop faster, while feeble-minded children lagged behind. Binet and Simon determined the average score that children of a given age got on a given test. They could then test other children and assign them a mental age based on how well they scored. A feeble-minded 10-year-old might have a mental age of 5. It shocked Goddard that a psychologist would try to measure the human mind without some finely machined instrument, a chronoscope, perhaps, or an automatograph. All Binet claimed he needed was for children to answer some questions. Other European researchers warned Goddard that the Simon Binet test was bogus, but he ended up tucking it into his papers anyway. When he arrived back in Vineland, he discovered it once more and decided to give it a try. After all, he had nothing left to lose. Goddard administered the test to some of the Vineland students and then looked over the scores. The Simon Binet test did a remarkably good job of matching the judgments of Vineland teachers. Students who had been determined to be idiots consistently got the lowest scores. The imbeciles did somewhat better, and the children who were simply slow and difficult, like Emma Wolverton, did better still, their mental ages lagging just a few years behind their chronological ones. Here, Goddard decided, was the measuring tool he had been searching for. Idiots had a mental age less than 3, imbeciles between 3 and 7. People like Emma Wolverton functioned at a higher level, but lacked a proper label. For those with a mental age between 8 and 12, Goddard reached back to his dreary classics classes and coined the word moron, based on the Greek word for fool. Goddard even sliced each of these new categories into 3 subdivisions apiece, low grade, medium grade, and high grade. Once Goddard was done testing Vineland students, he cast his eye over other schools. He managed to get permission to send out 5 assistants to a nearby school district and test 2,000 ordinary students. They found that 78% of children had a mental age within a year of their chronological age. 4% were more than a year ahead, while 15% were 2 to 3 years behind. Trailing at the rear, 3% of the children were 3 years behind. These figures practically amount to a mathematical proof of the accuracy of the Binet tests, Goddard declared. The regularity of the scores, no matter who took the tests, convinced him that they were accurately measuring a biological trait, the mysterious wellspring of intelligence in the brain. They may have also played a part in changing how he thought about intelligence itself. Instead of something malleable, which could be increased by strengthening brain cells, he came to see it as largely determined by heredity. "It cannot be cured," Goddard concluded. "It is caused, in at least 80% of cases, by disturbances of function in parents or grandparents that might have been prevented." When Goddard spoke this way, he betrayed his 19th-century concept of heredity. He shared the common belief that people who took up a life of crime or alcoholism might somehow taint future generations with their sins. Growing curious about the degeneration of his students, Goddard thumbed through Vineland's admission forms, looking for details about their families. He could find only a little information. To get more, he drafted an after-admission blank for parents and physicians to fill out. Goddard asked whether Vineland's students had any relatives who were insane, alcoholic, feeble-minded. When the blanks came back filled out, Goddard was surprised at how many relatives suffered from these weaknesses. To gauge the full scope, Goddard wanted to hire a team of skilled assistants to collect data on heredity. How he would pay for the project, Goddard couldn't say. In the midst of this uncertainty, a letter arrived at the school in March 1909 like an answered prayer. One of the country's leading scientists, a geneticist by the name of Charles Davenport, wanted to know if anyone at Vineland had data about the heredity of feeble-mindedness. Davenport had leaped to fame only a few years before writing to Vineland. He had earned a Ph.D. in zoology at Harvard in 1892, going on to a solid but obscure career studying scallops and other marine animals. He moved to Cold Spring Harbor, a Long Island village, where he ran a summer school for biology teachers. But Davenport had great ambitions far beyond beachcombing. He pioneered new statistical methods to make precise comparisons between animals, based on their size and shape. Once these methods had matured, Davenport predicted, "Biology will pass from the field of speculative sciences to exact sciences." He struggled to use statistics to understand heredity, comparing parents to their offspring. When Mendel's work came to light in 1900, with its concepts of dominant and recessive characters, it hit Davenport like a lightning bolt to the skull. Davenport persuaded the Carnegie Institution to turn Cold Spring Harbor from a sleepy summer school into a full-time research station for genetics. In 1904, the Station for Experimental Evolution opened its doors. Hugo de Vries traveled by train to Cold Spring Harbor and gave a speech to celebrate the event. He celebrated Davenport in particular as its director. "With him, it will open up wide fields of unexpected facts, bringing to light new methods of improvement of our domestic animals and plants," de Vries said. For his first few years as director, Davenport fulfilled that prediction. He brought together a team of scientists who embarked on studies on heredity, investigating flies, mice, rabbits, and ducks. George Shull, the botanist who would later inspect Luther Burbank's gardens, grew corn and primroses in the Cold Spring Harbor fields. Davenport himself studied chickens and canaries. Inspecting his canaries, he concluded that the crest of feathers on their head was a dominant Mendelian trait. But Davenport wasn't content with canaries. He wanted to decipher human heredity, too. Davenport couldn't study human heredity by raising experimental families. Instead, he set out to create a science of pedigrees. For centuries, people had been recording their genealogy, and sometimes those trees offered hints of heredity. The Habsburg jaw reappeared in generation after generation of royal portraits. In the 19th century, asylums kept records hinting that insanity tended to run in families. Davenport realized that if pedigrees were detailed enough, they might reveal Mendel's signature over many human generations. Working with his wife Gertrude, a zoologist, Davenport started with simple studies on the color of people's eyes and their hair. He then expanded his research, training a team of field workers to search across New England for families with hereditary disorders such as Huntington's disease. Davenport also wondered if American asylums and other institutions, homes for the deaf and blind, insane asylums, prisons, might already have the information he was looking for. When he wrote to the Vineland Training School, he was stunned to get a letter back from Goddard, explaining all the work he had already done. "I can hardly express my enthusiasm over these blanks," Davenport told Goddard, "and my enthusiasm that you are planning, I trust, extensive work in the pedigree of feeble-minded children." Davenport traveled to Vineland to meet Goddard and help launch the project. He showed Goddard how to manage field researchers and analyze the data they brought back. Most important of all, Davenport gave Goddard a crash course in genetics. By 1909, a growing number of biologists had come to accept Mendel's findings, but none of them could yet say for sure what was responsible for his patterns. The Danish plant physiologist Wilhelm Johansson gave Mendel's factors a new name, genes. As to the nature of the genes, Johansson warned, it is as yet of no value to propose any hypothesis. Under Davenport's guidance, Goddard swiftly embraced Mendelism. It remained to be seen whether feeble-mindedness was a recessive trait, arising in children when they inherited the same gene from both parents. To search for evidence, Goddard talked a Philadelphia philanthropist into paying for a study on heredity. He built up his field team, choosing only women, who he required to have a pleasing manner and address, such as inspire confidence, he said, along with a high degree of intelligence which would enable her to comprehend the problem of the feeble-minded. Goddard would come to depend most of all on his top field worker, a former school principal named Elizabeth Kite, who had studied at the Sorbonne and the University of London. Kite and the other field workers began traveling to meet the families of the Vineland students. Within a matter of months, Goddard claimed he saw patterns that seemed to conform perfectly to the Mendelian law. Writing about the results in the school's annual report, he predicted great things for Vineland. Once we prove that the law holds true for man, we shall be in the possession of a powerful solvent for some of the most troublesome problems, he said. We are within reach of a great contribution to science that would make the New Jersey Training School famous the world over and for all time. Fanning out from Vineland across New Jersey and neighboring states, Goddard's field workers gathered data on 327 families of students. In a few cases, the families had normal intelligence. The feeble-mindedness of the students seemed to arise from some unknown source. It was far more common, however, for the field workers to find families with many feeble-minded members, not to mention alcoholics and criminals. Back in Vineland, Goddard gathered what he believed to be more evidence that feeble-mindedness was inherited, like Mendel's wrinkled peas. If two feeble-minded parents had children, the school records seemed to show, much of their family might end up feeble-minded too. Based on his pedigrees, Goddard estimated that about two-thirds of feeble-minded people owed their condition to heredity. They have inherited the condition just as you have inherited the color of your eyes, the color of your hair, and the shape of your head, he said. This dawning realization revolted Goddard. He felt as if he was pulling a scrim away from American society, revealing a hidden rot. And none of the stories gathered by his field workers appalled him more than that of Emma Wolverton. When Goddard first examined Emma, she seemed just one of many morons in the school's care. She was a pleasant enough student within the confines of Vineland. But she would be doomed if she stepped off the property. She would lead a life that would be vicious, immoral, and criminal. Though because of her mentality, she herself would not be responsible, Goddard predicted. Goddard's curiosity about Emma sharpened when Kite dug into the history of the Wolverton family. Kite first managed to track down Emma's mother, Melinda. By then, Melinda had 8 children and was earning money by working as a farmhand and selling soap. Kite told Goddard that Melinda seemed indifferent to her family, even to herself. Her philosophy of life is the philosophy of the animal, Goddard later declared. Kite pushed further back into Emma's pedigree. She investigated Emma's aunts and uncles and cousins. She traveled to the reaches of New Jersey, to slums, to farms, to mountain cabins, and came back with more disturbing tales of filthy half-naked children, of unheated tenements, of mothers covered in vermin, of incest. Kite sometimes proffered a letter from the school to get into people's houses, but other times she hid her mission, sweetly asking if she could get shelter from impending storms or pretending to be a historian researching the Revolutionary War. She asked old people about their dim memories of long-dead relatives. They told of horse thieves, of young women seduced by lawyers, of an old drunk nicknamed Old Horror who would show up at the polls on election day to vote for whoever would pay him. Kite eventually traced 480 Wolvertons to a single founding father named John Wolverton. She claimed conclusive proof of feeble-mindedness in 143 of his descendants. But Kite also encountered descendants of John Wolverton who were doctors, lawyers, businessmen, and other respectable citizens. Their intelligence seemed utterly different from Emma's relatives. The two branches of the family, the high and the low, didn't seem to know of each other. Kite was confused until an elderly informant dispelled the fog. John Wolverton, Kite learned, had been born into an upstanding colonial family. At the outbreak of the Revolutionary War, he joined a militia, and when the militia stopped one night at a tavern, he got drunk and slept with a feeble-minded girl who worked there. John promptly got back on the respectable path, married a woman of good Quaker stock, and went on to have a happy family, with many descendants who rose to prominence. John had no idea that he had impregnated the tavern girl, who gave birth to a feeble-minded son. She named him John Wolverton after his missing father. When John the Younger grew up, he turned out an utterly different man, depraved enough to earn the nickname Old Horror. He started a family of his own, and the two lines of Wolvertons veered in different directions over the next 130 years, one to greater respectability, the other into feeble-mindedness and crime. The biologists could hardly plan and carry out a more rigid experiment, Goddard said. The data flowing into Vineland was among the most valuable that have ever been contributed to the subject of human heredity, he said. Goddard convinced himself the United States was sliding into a crisis of heredity. If civilization is to advance, our best people must replenish the earth, he said. To Goddard, the best people in the United States were his fellow New Englanders, the stock than which there is no better. But one by one, the great New England families were disappearing for lack of children. Meanwhile, the feeble-minded were multiplying at over twice the average rate, according to Goddard's estimates. Goddard was hardly the first person to contemplate controlling human heredity. 4 centuries beforehand, Luis Mercado had advised people with hereditary disorders to avoid having children together. In the early 1800s, alienists urged that the insane be prevented from starting families. Francis Galton turned these concerns into something far more extreme, a call to governments to breed their citizens like cows or corn. Galton recognized that in order to win people to his cause, he would need, as he put it, a brief word to express the science of improving stock. In 1883, he came up with an enduring term, eugenics. To Galton, eugenics was full of happy visions of arranged marriages that would lead to ever better generations of humans. What a galaxy of genius might we not create, Galton promised. Galton's enthusiasm attracted some noteworthy English biologists who formed the Eugenics Education Society, but they never gained much power or influence over British affairs. By the dawn of the 20th century, eugenics had begun taking root in the United States, and there it flowered into darker blooms. American eugenicists wanted to prevent people with bad traits from having children. Some argued for institutionalizing the feeble-minded to stop them from having sex. Some called for sterilization. In 1900, an American physician named W.D. McKim went so far as to call for a gentle, painless death. He envisioned the construction of gas chambers to kill the very weak and the very vicious. It would be pointless to try to improve these people through experience because, McKim declared, heredity is the fundamental cause of human wretchedness. Davenport embraced eugenics without any hesitation, and he argued that Mendel's rediscovery only strengthened the case for it. If genes were carried in the germline, there was nothing to be done about the bad ones except to keep them from poisoning the next generation. Davenport believed that eugenics would have to be carried out based on a thorough knowledge of hereditary traits, and so he established a repository of data, the Eugenics Record Office, next to the research station at Cold Spring Harbor in 1910. Ultimately, Davenport predicted, eugenics would provide the salvation of the race through heredity. Under Davenport's sway, Goddard quickly became a eugenicist too. In 1909, he joined Davenport on a prominent committee of eugenicists, and 2 years later he published a manifesto entitled The Elimination of Feeble-Mindedness. Goddard wrote that it was possible for environmental causes, such as an illness during pregnancy, to cause feeble-mindedness, but all these causes combined are small compared to the one cause, heredity. To eliminate feeble-mindedness, Goddard rejected the calls of people like McKim to kill the feeble-minded, but he did want to make sure they didn't get to have children, and by they, Goddard mostly meant women. Goddard conjured up a specter of attractive, feeble-minded women wantonly seducing decent men. He warned that the country's reformatories were full of feeble-minded girls who do not conform to the conventions of society, who were boy-crazy, or, worst of all, preferred the company of colored men to white. These feeble-minded girls, in many instances, are quite attractive, Goddard warned, requiring them to be put under the care, guidance and direction of intelligent and humane people who will make their lives happy and partially useful, but who will insist upon the one important thing, and that is that this race should end with them. They shall never become the mothers of children who are like themselves. Institutionalization wasn't the only way to keep women from becoming mothers.